This is the Dairy Download, brought to you by Blumling & Associates and the International Dairy Foods Association, where we offer sharp market and policy insights on dairy. I'm your host, Phil Plord.
And I'm your co-host, Kathleen Wolfley.
Today's episode is all about walking the tightrope. We'll talk to an owner of the nation's largest natural cheese packager about how his company is managing in this new normal. Then we chat with one of the brightest ag economists out there about risk management, the Farm Bill, and federal orders. We'll tackle all that in a few minutes.
Our sponsor for today's show is the good folks at Standpack. For 70 years, Standpack has been manufacturing milk and ice cream packaging for companies located throughout North America. Contact Standpack and experience their legendary service.
Thanks, Standpack. And thanks, Kathleen. Where are we now?
Well, we landed today with the block market at $2.72 a pound. That's up 7 cents on the week. Barrels finished at $2.21, up 21 cents on the week. Butter finished at $1.50, up a nickel. And the non-factory milk market was flat at $1.14. So, Phil, what do you think is the most important thing in the markets today?
You know, you and I had a very interesting conversation with a client yesterday that triggered a thought for me. You know, we're just a few weeks away from Thanksgiving now, and traditionally, in more normal times, we'd be really cranking up the retail promotions around certain dairy products, especially butter. So there's a couple of interesting questions as far as I'm concerned. So the first one is, how much promotional activity are we going to see this season? And our client said something really interesting. He said that a lot of grocers are especially aware of the fact that in this COVID era, customers are not shopping multiple outlets. They kind of have a steady now. They're going to one store. And so retailers are really, really starting to focus on how are they the one. And you're starting to see a little bit more promotional activity in concert with that recognition. From there, when we think about butter, are we going to use that much more this year? We've already been using a lot of butter, right? Sales have been up 10, 15, 20% pretty consistently at retail. And normally this time of the year, we bake more cookies, more confection, all that kind of stuff. Well, we're already eating a lot of cookies. So the question I have is, are we going to bake that many more? What about in your house, Kathleen? Are you making that many more cookies in the next 6 weeks, you think, than you've already been making?
I maybe shouldn't admit this, but I used an entire pound of butter over the weekend, liquidating some of my frozen butter supplies that I've been stocking away all summer.
So Kathleen, what do you think is the most important thing right now?
What I'm watching is the 40-pound block market. We continue to hear that things are really tight out there in the marketplace, and I should be more specific, fresh 40-pound blocks, that's 4 to 30 days of age. We saw 7 lots trade last week in Chicago, and so far this week we've seen 1 lot on Monday and Tuesday, 3 lots today. I just wonder, is this market going to stay tight for how much longer?
Another piece of information we picked up from a client this week is that cheddar sales are outperforming the category. So when you look at retail sales being up 10 to 15% pretty consistently, you know, we've seen some data now that shows that cheddar sales are up 27%. So that's better than the category. Other flavors are up only 15%, for example. And when you look at it even deeper, shredded cheese, which is what we use 40-pound blocks to make for the most part, shredded cheese sales are up about 35% year over year, which is outperforming chunks and slices. And so those are my stats for the week, by the way, just full disclosure. So I think that when you wonder why things are tight on the block cheddar side, you know, we're using a lot of those fresh cheddar blocks to make mild shreds that are selling quite well in grocery stores. What about you, Kathleen? Do you have a stat of the week?
Well, my stat of the week is maybe a little bit more global. I saw that IMF put out a report this week suggesting that governments have committed a record 12% of the global output to help fight coronavirus and to help stem the economic downturn. I've seen a lot of estimates out there that suggest we should see a fairly swift rebound in the global economy as we go into 2021. But given how much these governments are going into debt, I wonder how much of a headwind we're going to face as we go into the next year and how that could stifle some of the recovery.
Any fearless predictions this week, Kathleen?
My fearless prediction is that we've hit a wall in the nonfat market, and I think it's going to take quite a bit of momentum to push through it. And I just don't think this market has the momentum to push past that $1.15-ish mark today. How about for you?
Well, I believe next week we get the latest USDA milk production report. Our model is calling for 1.3% year-over-year growth in U.S. production, and I'm going to take the over on that. My fearless prediction is that milk production in September was up by 1.5% or more compared to last year's levels.
Well, Phil, it's probably about time that we get to our first guest. He's a familiar face to many in the dairy industry.
Today, we are excited to speak with Kurt Epprick. Kurt is the Vice President of Cheese Quality and Dairy Policy at Great Lakes Cheese, a company launched by the Epprick family in 1958. Great Lakes Cheese has 9 plants across the U.S. that package millions and millions of pounds of cheese for retail and food service accounts. Let's put it this way. If you eat cheese, there's a good chance you've had a slice, chunk, or shred that's passed through a Great Lakes facility. Kurt, welcome to the Dairy Download.
Thank you very much, Phil and Kathleen. I'm excited to be here.
We know that Great Lakes purchases the vast majority of the cheese it packages, but I want to start today talking about a cheese you make. Cheese that I happen to think is the best tasting cheddar in these United States. So, Kurt, what makes Adams Reserve cheddar so good?
You know, this is going to make Kathleen smile, but I'd be remiss if I didn't say it's that quality New York milk. And there are some regional subtle differences in milk from the different parts of the United States, and we think that that is a big building block of what makes it good. Beyond that, it's an established plant with a lot of seasoned, experienced employees, and we have a real stable make, and we hit our control points, and the end result is a darn fine piece of cheese, as it's won a number of best sharp cheddar awards, both in the world as well as in the United States.
Kurt, your family's been in the cheese and dairy business for decades. How did you in particular get the start?
Well, if you've met my father, you know he can be very persuasive. And I think my employment or maybe indentured servitude started before I was a teenager, cutting lawn and doing landscaping, and kind of proceeded to doing cleanup jobs and then production jobs as I went through high school. And it's sad to say, but I think I looked at two-a-days in football practice as being easier than working in some of the jobs in the plant. But during that time working as a teenager, you know, I fell in love with cheese. I fell in love with the people I work with. And, you know, as a family, we've always given gifts as cheese. And it is amazing what people, the elation people get when they get a special piece of cheese and the excitement when they find something they like.
If we could, let's talk about supply chain volatility. How did you handle the massive rotation between food service and the retail business early on in 2020?
Clearly, we had huge change on both sides of the ledger. We had food service business that really just signed off. And shortly after that, we had retail business that took off. I think, how did we deal with it? We have some really great employees that are dedicated to their job and took their responsibility of first line workers. We worked a lot of overtime filling orders. I think our model is a little more able to flex than some other models, and we were flexed. On the other side of that, you know, we did work with our food service customers to work through inventories and try to keep them in business and keep product moving. But there were losses and there were winners and losers in that process.
So how do you see things playing out in the months ahead on that front? I mean, in terms of that retail versus restaurant mix, are restaurants asking you for different things these days? Are retailers?
That is important. Listening to the customer and trying to provide the customer with what they want. I think flexibility. We've had food service products that have sold at retail and had success, and we've had more consumer products that have gone into food service and had some success. We've turned everything upside down and people are trying to focus on what works and can fill a need.
From the food service perspective, are you seeing demand for different types of cheeses from those accounts than before, or is it about the same?
Unfortunately, some of the specialty products have probably suffered some, with fine dining being down. I think we've seen the most growth or the consistent sales on the core products more than anything. I would say that, you know, cheddar, there's a reason why we've had such volatile markets. Cheddar has clearly been the anchor item, and mozzarella not far behind.
You talked a little bit about cheese volatility. What do you see as the biggest challenge that cheese market price volatility is presented for dairy producers and manufacturers? And have there been any bright spots to that volatility?
I think, you know, when you look at the farmer, the boom and the bust has been challenging. I think the farmer is a little disenchanted with the spread between block and barrel and the negative PPD that that creates in a lot of the federal milk orders. You know, from a business perspective, inventory management has been a challenge. And with those prices have gone up because demand cycles have been that bad and that good. And so we have those markets that have kind of broke out of the normal comfort zone because of the excesses and extreme tightness. I think every supply chain and supply chain manager from procurement and trucking to inventory management and then operation production has been on their toes and been challenged through this course because it's taken an all hands on deck approach. And I think we're all looking at risk management. You need to have consistent volume to do risk management. And that has been hard to equate in these times. Well, you asked me about what the bright spots were. I think the industry is going to step up their risk management efforts going forward out of necessity. And so I think a lot more solutions are going to be evaluated and potentially enacted when it comes to trying to limit volatility when we can go from $1 to $3 in cheese price.
I want to ask you about Hans, your dad, for a second. I think we saw him at Dairy Farm last year. He's still out and about. Do you talk to him often about the industry and this year? I'd be curious to know if he has had any views on what he's seen this year or any perspective that Hans and several years of wisdom might add to the conversation.
That's an interesting question, Phil. And the bottom line is he never thought he would see $3 and $1 in the same year. He, like everybody at Great Lakes Cheese, thinks the future is not all doom and gloom, but clearly we have to figure out what COVID is and how we're going to get past it. You know, he does kind of say, boy, compared to the way we used to do things, I don't know if we could have turned on, Great Lakes Cheese couldn't have turned on a dime if it was 20 years ago like we can now with technology and the people and the insights. So I think he gave a kudos to the team at Great Lakes Cheese, but also the whole industry, because we were probably a little more set in our ways 20 years ago than we are now. I think all the organizations have realized they have to be flexible and be ready to change when the time comes. And you can't make up your own schedule. It has to be at your customer's schedule or the market's schedule.
Okay. Well, Kurt, thank you for joining us today. If people want to learn more about Great Lakes Cheese, they can go to greatlakescheese.com, correct?
Correct. Thank you, Phil. Thank you, Kathleen.
Let's shift gears and get the Washington perspective from one of the nation's brightest ag economists.
We are delighted to have John Newton with us. John is chief economist with the American Farm Bureau Federation. He's also spent time with the National Milk Producers Federation and in university ag econ circles. That's all nice. John's really smart and he's a great guy. But here's the thing I love most about John. He and his team produce exceptional graphs, tables, and charts. You can often find them on the Farm Bureau Twitter feed. John, welcome to the Dairy Download.
Thanks for having me, Phil. Excited to be here.
Clearly, it's been a crazy year. Let's start with this. From where you sit, how has the dairy industry weathered the COVID-19 storm so far?
A lot of the dairy farmers have just been hit with struggle after struggle after struggle this year. You talk about the milk price decline that we saw this spring. Folks that did the right thing and got a risk management plan in place, whether it's DMC or DRP or using futures and options contracts, got hit pretty hard with the negative PPDs and large depooling. And most recently, my phone's been ringing off the hook because Class 1 milk prices, they were changed in the 18 Farm Bill, and now dairy farmers are looking at that as another source of lost revenue. So I think it's been a pretty tough year for the farm. Even though we see milk prices have gained some strength following COVID, not all that money's making it back to the dairy farmer. And I think that's the challenge.
From where you sit, from a margin perspective, I understand certainly that $24 milk in the Class 3 price in July wasn't $24 milk on the farm, given all those factors you cited. But from an overall profitability perspective, do you think farmers have been in okay shape or in dire straits?
You know, I think we would have been in much more dire straits had the administration not come in and Congress, quite frankly, with the two COVID relief packages. Combined with existing resources, USDA's rolled out $30 billion in COVID assistance. And dairy's been a huge beneficiary of the CFAP program. And we haven't seen that type of ad hoc support in the dairy industry, to my knowledge, ever. So this is the most support that the farmers received. And that comes on the back of DMC payments, comes on the back of DRP payments. Well, DRP is an insurance product. And it also comes following 2 years of trade assistance payments. So I think had we not had that level of support in the industry, folks would have been a lot worse off.
The election is less than 30 days away at this point. What happens if, when the money goes away?
You know, we consistently say, look, farmers want to farm for the market. And you know, we didn't ask to see 99% of the tariff lines for agriculture that were going into China hit with a retaliatory tariff. You know, no one asked for COVID-19. When I talked to our producers in January, we had our annual convention, folks were really optimistic that 2020 was going to be a better year. That light at the end of the tunnel in March turned out to be a freight train. And I think everybody's been trying to pick up the pieces.
What long-term lessons can policymakers take from the way COVID impacted the ag industry so far and the dairy sector in particular?
So one of the conversations that folks have had on the Hill, and I think the same for dairy, is do we need to build in shock absorbers in the event that this happens in the future? Do we need extra processing capacity so that if a plant goes down, we've got the lines that we can run products through? I think the other thing that folks are interested in is looking at the CFTC, looking at our futures markets, our derivative instruments, looking at the cash markets we're in. That's got a big spotlight on it now. USDA has a cattle market investigation. CFTC has one. While there's not one in dairy, I think folks have looked at the market volatility that we've seen in these derivative markets and said, you know, do we need to do something about that? And I think Chairman Tarver is going to put together a task force to think about how do these derivative instruments need to function in a pandemic. We've got a system in this country of pricing and marketing milk that was based on a time when 60% of the milk was class one. Pretty soon, there's going to be more milk products exported than we have in the class one market. Yet we've got this golden goose we continue to try to get eggs out of. It needs to be looked at, needs to be looked at thoroughly. I think folks have figured out, quite frankly, how to make money in federal orders, and they're too scared to change.
We've heard Congressman Colin Peterson say that the industry finally has a robust dairy safety net that will protect nearly all farms. And I know you were deeply involved with the creation of Dairy DRP. What are your thoughts on how farmers are adapting to programs like DRP and DMC?
Oh, this is a fantastic question. So I'll first start with DMC. DMC is an insurance-like program. It's part of Title I of the Farm Bill. And even when I worked for Chairwoman Stabenow on the Senate Ag Committee, you know, I scratched my head at why are we trying to make a target deficiency payment program look like insurance? If you want to deliver direct payments to dairy producers, then deliver direct payments to dairy producers. And that's what we did in the 18 Farm Bill with DMC. You made it look still like insurance. There's a nominal premium of 15 cents per hundredweight, but the margin's so high and you adjusted the alfalfa that it's darn near a direct payment. Dairy's the only Title I program that has a premium. Everybody else just elects their coverage. They get the best coverage that's available for their operation. And you move forward. The challenge with the old MPP that I pointed out very early on was that it wasn't actuarially appropriate. That was an insurance-like product that was either always in the money or always out of the money whenever you bought it. And the beauty of dairy revenue is it addresses all the deficiencies of LGM dairy. It's available every single day, and you can customize it to capture your component price risk, try to capture some of that basis risk, or you can move and use class three and class four. But more than anything, what's made DRP so successful, Phil, is folks like you that deliver it to producers. People that are touching the farmers every single day are delivering DRP, making it part of their risk management toolbox. And I think that's why it's been so successful. It's now one of the top 10 crop insurance products on the market.
If I may shift gears a little bit, where do you think we are on trade?
What part of the world do you want to go to? Do you want to the phase one deal with China? You know, unless you've been under a rock, it's not going to happen this year, but that's a longer term deal. So I think you judge it based on the 2 year merit, not a single year. And then they've made a number of structural changes, including structural changes that benefit dairy. I think 50 out of the 57 structural changes that they pledged to change, they did. So I think things will get better. I think that's going to hinge a lot on when global economies start to turn around.
What's your sense of the health of the global economy as we head into the tail end of 2020 and into 2021?
We need a stimulus package. Whether that happens before or after the election remains to be seen. We need to keep our small businesses afloat. We need to keep our restaurants, our airlines afloat, so that when we get to the other side of this, we got an economy to go back to.
Sooner or later, we're going to be in farm bill mode. It's going to happen at some point. What should the priorities be for the dairy industry as we get closer?
That's an interesting question. I mean, I think as Chairman Peterson and you alluded to, the dairy safety net right now is as good as it's ever been. But overall, let's set dairy aside and talk about the overall farm bill. The question is going to be, is it adequate enough to provide the protection that folks need? And when you look at the ad hoc support that we've seen from retaliatory tariffs or COVID-19, I think many are going to argue that the farm bill is not adequate enough of a safety net. You need higher price support, higher revenue triggers in that. But the challenge will be, where do we find the money? And then the $1 million part of the farm bill that we haven't even touched on yet, Phil, is conservation and climate smart ag. And how do we increase the adoption of that? How do we create the proper incentives for voluntary climate smart adoption in agriculture?
On that last point, how do you view your role from a Farm Bureau perspective in, you know, bridging whatever gaps there are between that environmental sustainability argument, point of view? How do you view that?
If your listeners could see me now, I'm actually standing on a tightrope. That's how difficult the conversation is. I mean, we've got policy that supports, you know, voluntary efforts to increase climate smart technologies. We're opposed to a carbon tax. We're opposed to, you know, mandate, you know, but the train is coming down the tracks. My boss, President Zippy Duval, says, you know, if you're not at the table, you're the meal. And I think if we can create the proper incentives, then more farmers will adopt these practices. Quite frankly, if you can squeeze a penny out of it, it'll be adopted across the country. But right now, you know, some of these practices in practice haven't shown long-term profitability. And I think that's been the barrier.
All right, John. Well, thank you very much today for joining us on the Dairy Download.
I always appreciate it. Thank you so much.
That's a wrap for today's show. As always, we want to thank our production team, Matt Herrick, Michael Gooden, and Andrew Jerome at IDFA, and Corey Romero over here at Blooming & Associates. If you're interested in what Kathleen and I do for our day jobs, check us out at www.dairy.com.
Again, a huge thanks to our sponsors, Standpack. Contact Standpack to experience their legendary service. Thanks for listening to the Dairy Download. Until next time, stay sharp.